Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders. Last year, along with John Nichols, the great progressive journalist with The Nation magazine, I wrote a best-selling book called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. In it, we tackle the issues that you don't hear much about in the mainstream media, from the extraordinary wealth and income inequality that our nation is experiencing, to the growing labor movement, to corporate control over the media itself. If I must say so myself, this is a very good book, and it's just been republished in paperback. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.
So, Senator, we're going
to... Well, John, yeah. It's good to be with you, and thank you very much for your help on the book. I remember those long days and nights in Burlington out on the porch.
Yeah.
Going over a whole lot of stuff, so thank you very much.
It was a interesting adventure, and I always tell people that you're easier to work with than people think.
I don't know exactly what that means.
No, but you were surprisingly engaged.
But I don't know what people think. That's the concern.
They all think you're very easy to work with.
Okay. Sure.
So let me talk about, let's start out in the moment where we're at now. And we'll work our way back through some of the subjects in the book. And it happens we're talking in an election year. And the book deals a lot with politics. It starts out looking at some of your campaigns along the way, building up to that 2020 race where Donald Trump got beat by Joe Biden. And so let me begin by asking you, what should people be thinking about politics right now?
Well, I think they should be appreciating that this election is of extraordinary importance in so many respects. It is important because we are running against the most dangerous political figure in the modern history of this country. And I just want to make it clear to people what a Trump victory is about. I think sometimes we slouch it off. Trump does not believe in the concept of climate change. So what does that mean? It means not only that all of the work we have done in trying to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel will be undone, but every other country on earth is going to say, hey, if the second largest emitter in the world is given up on trying to transform the energy systems, we're not going to do it either. And that really means dooming our kids and future generations to a very, very unhealthy, perhaps uninhabitable world. So you don't need to know anything more than that to understand how dangerous Trump is. But obviously, the danger is much greater than just that. For decades, and I don't have to explain this to anybody who's watching or listening, women have had to struggle to secure their proper place in American society. Not there yet, but huge victories have been won over the years. And now what we have seen is a result of a Supreme Court decision fueled by Trump's three appointees to the Supreme Court. Roe v. Wade was overturned. And all across this country now, women are losing their basic rights to control their own bodies. And then you look at issues like healthcare. You had in Trump a president who wanted to throw 32 million people off the Affordable Care. I'm not a great fan of the Affordable Care. I believe in Medicare for all, but it was not insignificant. You don't just throw 32 million people off of that. You have a president in Trump who gave massive tax breaks at a time of wealth and income inequality of an unprecedented level, massive tax breaks to the billionaire class, and on and on and on it goes. So I think the point for me and what I will be saying for the next many, many months is, okay, people are not enthusiastic about Joe Biden. I got it. And we've got to do as much as we can to make Biden as progressive as he can. And I know we're all concerned. I hope we're all concerned about the horrible situation now in Gaza, where Biden has not been as strong and effective as he should be. But we also have to take a look at the at what this election means overall and what it will mean if Trump gets elected, and we cannot allow that to happen.
And that gets to something that's always been a constant in your long political career, and that is that you obviously look, and you just did, at a number of issues of the moment, right? Issues, immediate issues, right? But there are also sort of the overarching issues, the big ones that that don't always get addressed in politics. And one of the striking things about the Biden presidency and the kind of run-up to it was that you had a lot of influence there. And a lot of, you were talking to the president a lot, you were pushing the president to move toward something, dare we say, attempting to approximate a new deal. Obviously, that didn't all get achieved, but that's also something that's at stake at this point, right? That possibility of going big.
One of the things, and that's right, John, where Biden does not get the credit that he deserves, is that I think on economic issues, he is prepared to think pretty big. And I know about that from a very personal level, because I worked with the president when I was chairman of the Budget Committee, and we were working on the American Rescue Plan. And I just want everybody, you know, as Americans, I think we, I don't know if it's a universal phenomenon, but we certainly do have short memory spans, right? So go back 3.5 years in the midst of the terrible COVID pandemic. And we remember hospitals being overrun with patients, thousands of people dying every year, no one knowing how we're going to get a handle on this terrible illness. I mean, what comes to my mind is nurses, doctors treating patients, but they didn't even have the protective equipment they needed, the masks, the gowns, the gloves that they needed, dying because they were trying to save lives. And in the midst of that pandemic, as we also recall when we think about it, is the economy collapsed. People were not going to work. And what we set out to do is to say, okay, you got a public health crisis. We got to deal with that, obviously. Trump did a terrible job on that, by and large. We got an economic crisis. We got to deal with that. What do we do? So we worked on what became known as the American Rescue Plan, the $1.9 trillion bill, which turned out to be the largest, I think, the largest single bill in the history of the country. And as people will remember, it provided $1,400 for every individual. When people were desperate for cash, it put money into housing and prevented evictions, extended unemployment, dealt in a very bold way with child care at the time, et cetera, et cetera. It was a very comprehensive emergency package.
It felt a little New Deal.
It was very New Deal. And I will tell you, say this, you know, it ended up at $1.9 trillion, which is a lot of money. I don't know that any single bill, non-appropriations bill, was ever that large. And Biden said, look, you can get more, do it. You get, I'll sign whatever you get. So he understood the enormity of the crisis facing the American people, was there with us. And what we ended up doing, and he doesn't get any credit for that, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of an economic downturn, we took the country out of that much faster than many of the pundits thought possible. So
let's talk about how we got to that point where a president, a Democratic president, would be open to going that big. And too much in politics, we tend to look at personalities. And we say, oh, right. Well, this is the great leader who's arrived. In reality, movements make things happen. And your 2016 and 2020 campaigns, which we talk about quite a bit in the book, those campaigns were about an attempt to transform not just the Democratic politics, but the politics of the country.
See, unlike Hillary Clinton in 2016, Biden did understand just what you're saying, that we were part, not just me, when we say not me, us, we were part of a mass movement of people. And Biden was smart enough to understand, A, these guys have some very good ideas, may not agree with them all, he doesn't, and B, if Mr. Biden, want to become president of the United States, you know what? Might be a good idea to work with these guys.
I got to steal some of these ideas.
And work with them.
Yeah.
So what we did is, you certainly know, and many of our viewers know, is Biden and I worked out an agreement that said, okay, look, we're going to do a series of task forces dealing with the major issues facing the country, healthcare, education, our climate, women's issues, etc. And we brought forth some of the leading progressive thinkers in the country. And Biden brought forth some of the, you know, leading liberal thinkers in the country, not as progressive as our people. And they sat down and they, you know, tried to work out positions that would be comfortable for both sides. And we did. And out of that, you know, in terms of climate, in terms of the economy, in terms of education, in terms of housing, came some pretty bold ideas, some of which became incorporated into the American Rescue Plan. But the intelligence of Biden was not to be intimidated or put off by this movement, but to try to work with it and to take as many of the ideas as, that he could comfortably take. And he took a lot.
And those shaped the campaign. It's not just the governing. It's that campaign that was actually won. And I, just to take a moment on this, I think that the task forces are underestimated by a lot of folks. There's not a consciousness. The people that you brought into those positions, people like Sarah Nelson from the Flight Attendants Union, and Stephanie Kelton, an economist,
and Alexandria, and
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others, and you put them right next to, in the case of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right next to John Kerry, the former Democratic candidate for president. So you were taking people from movements and putting them
right
in
into
the room.
Establishment, right?
Right, and that's significant. That's sort of, that in itself is a victory of a campaign, in a sense, because you were able to say to the Democratic Party, you got to start listening to these people.
Right. And I think what came out of that not only was the American Rescue Plan, but things like putting far more money into climate-related issues than people a few years before would have ever dreamed of. You know, when I campaigned for president, we talked about putting a huge amount of money in rebuilding our infrastructure, which clearly is crumbling, water, roads, bridges, etc. And, you know, what has happened over the last few years is we have passed the largest infrastructure, not as large as I wanted, but a very significant infrastructure bill. So the climate that we created, which said that millions of Americans want bold action, they want to think big, not small. They want transformative action, not just nibbling around the edges. I think that's had some impact on the Biden administration.
So let's not just talk about Biden. Let's talk about politics in the broader sense here for just a moment. And you have said to me many times that you think of one of the greatest accomplishments of your campaigns as bringing people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others into electoral politics, right?
Yep.
Convincing them that that's actually an avenue that might work, and campaigning for them, all these other aspects. And I think that's always been a great passion of yours, is to either inspire or at least encourage a lot of young activists to come into politics.
Well, I think one of the great success stories that does not get talked about a whole lot is the number of extremely energetic, young, progressive, often people of color, who are currently in the House of Representatives. You know, I think people say, wow, there's Alexandria. But there are many, many more. It's not just the squad. You got Greg Kazar from Texas, and you got Cori Bush from Missouri, and you got, you know, Rashida, and you got a whole bunch of other people. Way back in 1991, when I was first elected to the House, along with people like Maxine Waters, we helped form the Progressive Caucus. At that point, we had five people. The number now is well over 100, and many of them are really strong, energetic, young progressives. And my hope is that those numbers will grow. My hope is that that will be what the Democratic Party is, a party of working people. Many of these people come from working class backgrounds, people of color, young people. This is exactly what we want if we're going to transform politics in America.
But there still is a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party.
A battle? No, it's a war. Look, let's be very clear. We write about it in the book. I mean, we don't have to be tepid about this. There are many of the established Democrats who want nothing to do. They want to lock the door. And I told in this book, I think, you know, we wrote about it. I can remember, you know, when we ran all over this country doing event after event, often we would schedule them so that our rallies would correspond with Democratic Party events. So you go to Denver and there'd be a, you know, state Democratic event, and we do a rally in Denver as well. And the contrast between the two was like day and night. We would do a rally, there'd be 10,000 people out, people, you know, black and white and Latino, Asian American, gay and straight, the whole gambit of what America is, young and excited. And you go into the Democratic, the official, the established Democratic thing, which is mostly for a fundraiser and the, you know, middle-aged, older white guys and women who have money, lawyers and business people, all that, and no energy at all. It was like day and night. And if the Democratic Party is going to succeed, and right now they're not doing well, they're going to have to open that door. But it's not going to be, we're going to have to push that door open. They don't want to open it. And sometimes I think they'd rather go down with the ship so long as they control that ship rather than bring new people in, you know, bring working class people in, you know, bring people who are maybe don't have a PhD and a college degree, bring young people in who may not know all the workings of inside the Beltway. But that is the struggle that's going on. Either you open the doors of the Democratic Party to ordinary working people, young people, or else you continue to have that kind of moneyed establishment dominating the party. And that moneyed establishment is increasingly far removed from the needs of the working class of this country.
And it's and it doesn't, one of the realities, and we write about it in the book, is the moneyed establishment doesn't understand how to do a politics that actually connects with people.
They don't have no, they have no clue. They can't do it.
It's sort of horrible.
If you asked, if you called up the Democratic National Committee today, and they're very good at raising money. I mean, let's do it. That's what they,
that's
what their function is to raise money, hire consultants, put ads on television. But if you say organize, you know, a rally or a demonstration of eight people, we can't find eight people who are going to go out, walk on a picket line. We can't. They can't. They really can't. And which really takes us to the weird situation that, you know, as we, you know, we become more and more involved in the 2024 campaign, it's going to have to be the progressive movement that rallies the grassroots. I mean, we got to tell the truth here, and then Trump and his people have energized grassroots support. Democrats don't. And we're going to have to provide that support for the Democrats if we're going to be successful in defeating Trump.
So you're a very tech-savvy guy. You?
No, I am not, but I have smart people around me. I'm smart enough to know how important social media is.
And you were way ahead of the curve.
And there's one of them right there.
Yeah, we got people running our cameras here. But you built up an office and campaigns that have been, you know, on all the social media platforms and done all that. But one of the things that you've always been, dare I say, religious about is the idea that you also have to go out and talk to people. You have to actually go out.
What a quaint idea.
I know.
Think politicians should actually talk to people, John?
It's been said.
You're in Washington. Clearly, you don't know how it works here. We just raise money and we hire consultants. We do TV ads. Talk to people.
I know.
God, I don't know.
But you, in fact, we write about it a lot in the book, is because it's something that you are actually very passionate about.
Yep.
And that is in back in 2016, again in 2020, in Iowa, you literally talked to a measurable portion of the overall electorate.
Yes. Misty Rebick is now my chief of staff, was then my campaign manager. And she worked me tirelessly. In fact, I'm thinking of suing her because she worked me day after day, couldn't get a day off. Yeah. But no, the truth is, and we've done that in Vermont over the years. I've held more town meetings in Vermont than I think anybody in the history of the state. I love doing it. And when we were in Iowa, to a lesser degree in New Hampshire, that's what we did. And it was an extraordinary experience. So we write about it in the book. And what was extraordinary? Look, I get a thrill when you hold a rally for 25, 30,000 people. That's pretty exciting, no question about it. But I also get enormously excited about having a meeting for 200 or 300 people. And what we saw in Iowa and other states, and it was very moving to me, and it's something I will never forget, is the honesty and the trust that people had in us in coming forward often with tears in their eyes, talking about, I mean, we had one meeting on medical debt, and people talking about, you know their family, their finances, their family were destroyed, they couldn't pay their bills. People, I mean, just horrible stories about with medical debt, the absurdity and the dysfunctionality of our healthcare system. I mean, hearing people saying, well, you know, I have cancer and I couldn't pay the bill. I mean, being very personal. Mm-hmm. And that's what democracy is supposed to be about. What democracy is supposed to be about is you're telling what's going on really, really, really in your lives to somebody who's prepared to listen. And not only listen, but take what you say and try to figure out a way to deal with your problem. That's what democracy is supposed to be. That's why I'm a big fan of democracy. I mean, I love it. That's what the system is supposed to be. But it is happening less and less. I mean, just that dynamic. What's happening now is you do a poll. These are the issues. You hire a consultant. You put some cute 30-second ad up there. And hopefully those people will vote for you. That's what's going on. But I get my energy. You know, people say, well, Bernie, you're an old guy. How do you get your energy and all that stuff? That's how I get my energy. Talking to a lot of very beautiful people who are willing to share their life experience with me.
So let me talk about these. One of the things, and to me, it's one of the parts that I like the best about a book, and I suppose you can fall in love with a book that you're involved in. But one of the things that was so striking is that you remember so many of the stories of these people, that it actually had some sort of deep impact on you. And I remember talking about the bus trip from, I think,
Detroit
over to Windsor.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the issue of the outrageously high cost of prescription drugs is something that has bothered me for a very long time. And as chairman of the Senate Committee on Health and Education and Labor, we're beginning to deal with it. But can you imagine the insanity of somebody who is dealing with diabetes, mm-hmm. having to pay 10 times more for the same exact product that you can get 50 miles away or whatever it is in Windsor, Ontario? So we did this bus trip. And, you know, without going to all the details, I mean, people are crying. Yeah. Woman suddenly buys 10 times more product than she was able to have before for the same amount of price. And she had literally tears in her eyes. So all of those things, I mean, for me as a politician, where I get my energy from is from the people. And if I was unable, in fact, you know, one of the difficulties you have when you're a senator, chairman of a committee, you can't get out of Capitol Hill enough. And COVID obviously made it even more complicated. But getting your energy from people, hearing people, seeing so many extraordinary things. We, in the last couple of years, our office were probably involved in 15 or 20 strikes all over the country. Mm-hmm. And we were able to visit a few of them and talk to people on the phone. And just incredibly courageous people taking on large corporations, unbelievable solidarity. Everybody was in it together. It didn't matter the color of your skin or where you were born. Just people standing together for the common good. And when you see those things with your own eyes and the courage of people standing up to very powerful interests, it's very moving.
But it also means something when a politician shows up, right?
Oh, God,
when you actually come there. That's something I think a lot of politicians don't understand that.
Well, that gets into an even deeper issue, and that is the degree to which the whole political system is now alienated from the needs of ordinary people. So I'll tell you a story. I don't even know if we mentioned in the book or not. We went to Grand Rapids, Battle Creek,
Michigan.
Right. And there was a big strike going on there. And I had asked the president to write a letter. I was going to I led the rally. I said, you know, Mr. President, write a nice letter telling them you support their strike. And the letter they ended up writing was not the greatest letter in the world, to be honest with you. And I was hesitant whether or not to read it or not. You know, it wasn't really all there. And I read it, you know, it was being pro-union and all that stuff. It was okay. And people erupted in cheers. What did I learn? What they were saying is, oh my God, the President of the United States knows that there's a strike on here and what we're going through. And that's your point is well taken. So often, issues of enormous consequence are ignored by political leaders because they don't want to get in trouble, they don't want to antagonize their rich friends, their campaign contributors. And the result of all of that stuff is that people say, does anybody in Washington know that I exist? Do they know what's going on in my life? And those are the conditions that will lead to the demise of democracy if we don't turn it around.
And in the book we reference Roosevelt, FDR quite a bit in the book.
Yep.
And there is a reference, I hope I get it right here, a line where somebody asked somebody when Roosevelt's motorcade was going by. And the guy was crying or was all excited, and the reporter said to him, wow, do you know the president? And he says, no, I don't know the president, but he knows me.
Yeah, that's right. And that is, you know, 60%, not that I want to throw out a lot of statistics because I do that too often, but 60% of the American people are living paycheck to paycheck. I grew up in a family that lived paycheck to paycheck, so I know a little bit about that. But I am not sure that many of my colleagues understand what the stress is, the pain is in living paycheck to paycheck, the choices that families have to make, you know, whether you buy food or whether you pay for health care, you know, your landlord raises the rent, where do you take your kid, what can you do, you know, what school are you going to put your kid in? There is a huge gap between what many people in our country are experiencing and what goes on here in politics.
Well, let me, as we talk about this, let's come back to this current moment, the 2024 campaign, and also policymaking at this time. It seems to me that there's been a great gap between the response of the great mass of Americans, or an awful lot of Americans, to what's happening in Gaza. And what's happening in the administration?
Well, in Congress in general, Congress and the administration. General, yeah, absolutely. That is a very good example of the degree to which people here in D.C. live within the bubble. All over this country, whether you're a progressive, whether you're a moderate, whether you're a conservative, you look at these pictures, and you've seen these pictures of children literally starving to death right now in Gaza. And you understand that the United States has provided Netanyahu's government with billions and billions of dollars, and there's a bill that I voted against that passed the Senate, providing another $10 billion for unfettered military aid. And people all over the country are saying, why is the United States complicit? Why are we actually funding somebody who is blockading us, restrictions at the border? So that the trucks, the thousands of trucks that we need to get through to feed hungry children, he's stopping them. And we are giving him more money? How insane is that? But in Washington, D.C., there's another world. But I do want to tell you that I think it's beginning to change. You know, we just sent a letter to the president with, I can't remember, 8 or 9 senators on board that saying, it says very clearly, Israel is violating the law. The law is clear, Foreign Assistance Act. Any country that blocks U.S. humanitarian aid is in violation of the law, and they should not continue to get aid. And I think more and more people are coming to that position. But your essential point that where we started is American people are feeling one way, young people in overwhelming numbers, people of color, feeling very strongly about the injustice, the inhumanity, the horror of what's going on in Washington, living in another world.
Well, that's a good place to close this segment and to bring us back to, we were talking about the Democratic Party a little bit. And doesn't that really get to the heart of the challenge for the Democratic Party? Obviously, the Republican Party is going to be what it is. But the question is, will the Democratic Party be a party that actually listens to the mass movements and to the people who are its base or not? Because if it doesn't, then at some point, the connection gets broken, right?
The connection is
rally that coalition becomes much harder.
The connection is significantly broken already. I mean, I don't think most people have faith the Democratic Party is going to do very much. But, you know, people also see it as a far, far better alternative than Mr. Trump and the Republican Party. But, you know, again, getting back to what I said a few minutes ago, will the Democratic Party open their doors? Will they really be a party of the working class of this country, trying to address the needs of the working class, having the courage to take on the billionaire class? Well, it's hard to do it when you get a lot of money from the billionaire class, isn't it? You know, which takes us to campaign finance reform, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where we are.
It's funny you mentioned the billionaire class. That's our next segment.
Good.
So we'll close off here. And for folks who are listening to podcast or viewing, stick with us. We'll be back to talk more about oligarchy and the billionaire class.
If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.